Okay, next we will move into the Conservation Committee. Thank you, Chairman Freakin. I appreciate it. Next we'll move into the Conservation Committee. Chairman Bivens, please call your committee to order.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The first order of business of the Conservation Committee is approval of the previous committee meeting minutes, which have already been distributed. Is there a motion?
I'll move.
Hickson.
Second.
Second by Friedkin. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, same sign. Hearing none, motion passes. Committee item number one, update on TPW progress in implementing the TPW Land and Water Resources Conservation and Recreation Plan. Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Chairman. Appreciate it. With all the discussion on private lands, I think it's appropriate to highlight that tonight we have the Lone Star Land Steward Award winner celebration. So 5 to 7 there at the Marriott, we have some outstanding winners from around the state, and I hope all of you can be there to help us celebrate our private lands and conservation heritage. A couple of things, big trends happening on the private lands landscape that I think is most important that we talk a little bit about with y'all to make you aware of some of the key things that are happening out there that are impacting particularly our inland waters and terrestrial habitats. I hope that all of you had a chance to see the latest Parks and Wildlife magazine with what's happening with our East Texas forests. I think it's safe to say that in the last 10 years, we have probably witnessed the single largest divestiture of private lands that any of us will see in our lifetimes, with the decisions of the big timber companies to divest themselves of their land holdings and to sell those in large blocks to timber investment management organizations who have very different profit horizons and motives with that land. The most recent of which, of course, was Temple Inland, that sold all of their approximately 2 million acre interest in Texas and Louisiana and Georgia. And that has important implications for our teams in East Texas that are working to manage wildlife on large scales, with the TMOs and other landowners looking to maximize value for shareholders. And so they're looking at, you know, how do they parcelize those tracts, how do they sell them, how do they generate the most return from a timber perspective. And so we will probably start to see more and more fragmentation in East Texas, an area of the state that is already heavily, heavily fragmented. Also, as you heard from Linda, it's impacting our public hunting program. You know, for instance, the Campbell Company, which bought, they were the successor interest to all of the Temple Inland lands. I mean, they have essentially informed us that over the next 5 years, they are going to wind down and phase out their participation in the public hunting program. So they've given us advance notice, but, you know, there's upwards of 50,000 acres that we will probably lose from the program in the next 5 years. So what's happening in those East Texas forests has huge implications from a wildlife perspective, and I think it's important that we as an agency do all we can to highlight that part of the state and the biological diversity and the conservation implications, and the magazine really did a great job of capturing that. Commissioner, up in your neck of the woods, so to speak, you know, we're facing some similar challenges with the Conservation Reserve Program. I mean, arguably one of the most important landscape-scale conservation programs that was ever implemented, largely to help control erosion. You know, we have almost 4 million acres of CRP lands in the panhandle. We are expecting about a quarter of those lands to come up for lease renewal in the next 12 months or so, and by 2012, all of them will come up for lease renewal. And there's some important implications for that. One, many of these lands are owned by retired farmers and folks that depend upon those revenue streams from those CRP payments to help sustain their livelihoods. Secondly, there was a decision in the 2008 Farm Bill to reduce the cap of acres nationally from 39 million acres in CRP to 32 million acres, which means that folks that want to re-enroll those acres in CRP may be bumping up against a cap. And so landowners are going to be presented choices to break that out in production agriculture, again, highly erodible lands. Lands that have been restored to grasslands that are benefiting bobwhite quail, lesser prairie chicken in many cases, pronghorn, mule deer, the whole suite of grassland birds that we concern ourselves with. So some very, very significant implications on the horizon. Our teams are working diligently to try to reach out to landowners to make sure that they know what their options are, you know, after the the CRP, and so are putting together technical guidance booklets, outreach seminars to landowners, and doing everything they can to inform folks that have lands in CRP how they can re-enroll if possible, or explore compatible revenue generation streams that will be consistent with our mission. So two major trends on the private lands landscape that I think are very, very germane to the mission of this agency and what we're talking about in the bigger private land situation. So wanted to just share a few words about that this morning with y'all.
I guess in that regard, I have one question on the East Texas issue. Have we had any discussion with the management of this Campbell company that has notified us of their intent to discontinue public hunting as to the reasoning or their, I mean, I'm sure there's some profit potential in there somewhere, but is there no way that we could negotiate with them in order to try to maintain some access?
Well, and I think our teams have been negotiating with them. Commissioner Linda and Nathan and the teams, I think, sit down with them pretty regularly. I think they have put forth a very kind of orderly plan by which they're letting us know they're going to have to wind this down. I think as they sell lands, or as they have, you know, certainly aware of that there are probably other more competitive pricing gains that they can get from leasing it out to the private sector. So in some cases, we're just not competitive from a leasing perspective. They've been a good partner, a strong partner, and the fact that they're giving us this much notice that we're going to lose this acreage is certainly very beneficial from our planning perspective. Just unfortunately, one of the many implications of these big land transfers. Good question.
Thank you.
I have a question. Do we have any communication with some of the appraisal districts? I've actually had a few approach me saying that, you know, they're faced with, you know, concerns and situations that they really don't know how to best deal with appropriately in some of this land fragmentation and in some of these lands that are going into different opportunities and uses. Do we have any type of a partnership or open dialogue with?
Yeah, very, very good question. Linda and her team and our private lands biologists around the state work very closely with the appraisal communities in each county. You know, we're obviously encouraging private landowners where appropriate to enroll their lands in wildlife use valuations where they had a pre-existing ag or timber use, and encouraging that. We just went through an exercise with the Comptroller's Office and the Department of Agriculture, Texas Wildlife Association, and many other stakeholders to update the rules for the wildlife use valuation and who could apply. Legal was very, very involved in developing some of those new rules. And so, yeah, there's a very active dialogue to try to help them kind of make good decisions about which lands are eligible for that. So
I may at a later time ask for their assistance or pass on some of the information to help some of these individuals in long-term help, you know, the landowners as well. Just in, they were actually having some difficulty in actually using some of the language, whereas maybe something was a shed and they had it as a warehouse and that was changing. So they were looking for different guidelines. So I may get back
some of the
them.
Improvements that are on the property and how those are appraised.
And how they're the proper language to identify them with. So maybe I'll visit with
Linda Campbell, yeah.
Later and great.
Yep.
Thank you. Committee item number 2, status on the update of the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department Land and Water Resources Conservation and Recreation Plan. Mr. Scott Orr.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, my name is Scott Borough. I'm the Deputy Executive Director of Operations. I'd like to take just a moment to congratulate the Commissioners on your recent confirmation by the Senate, and especially to welcome Mr. Morian to the Texas Parks and Wildlife family. We look forward to working with you, Mr. Morian. This is an important time, and I also recognize once again Ross Valenchuk and Mike Jensen back here, not probably because they need the recognition so much, because I think this does set up a point in time that's very important for the agency as we move forward. Obviously, our land and water resources conservation and recreation plan, that's the last time I'll say it that way, more affectionately known as the land and water plan around the agency, is obviously one of our two most important strategic documents that we use in this agency to direct the activities that in conservation and recreation that we're trying to effectuate. The natural agenda is the other strategic plan that I won't talk about today, but it's very important to the agency. It really sets some of the spending parameters and defines the ways that we both receive and are requested to use the money that comes into the agency. So the partner document to that natural resource document is the land and water plan, affectionately.
Get this up here.
The plan was originally crafted at the request of the legislature right after the turn of the century. That was number one. We, in 2005, at the request of the commission, updated the land and water plan once again. And most recently, under Chairman Holtz and Mr. Smith's direction, we are in the process of updating the plan yet again. We have been working on this plan for several months now. We have decided to create around the state what we are affectionately calling conservation and recreation forums. These are simply large meetings where we pull together both our internal resources and our friends out there, the NGO community, other agencies, and other conservation-related organizations. So we're trying to cast a broad net to get lots of feedback about what's important for the strategic operations of this agency. We have developed a pretty specific plan of attack, which includes putting together very dynamic teams out on the ground. And you can see the list of the teams here. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on each one of these other than to say to you that we have basically divided the workload amongst teams that are doing different things to bring to the table all this important feedback that we're trying to get. We did get clear direction from Mr. Holt and this commission and Mr. Smith as we started this process to make some changes in the plan. And that's not to suggest that the previous plan wasn't a good plan, because I think it was. It was well documented that it was used in many different ways. But a couple of the things that the leadership asked us to do is to make the plan a little simpler and easier to be understood and read. You know, to be something that people would like to look at the same time as they're reading it. That ownership of the plan was a key ingredient of success, and that we wanted both our staff in the field, our partners around the state, and the leadership downtown and elsewhere around the state to be able to embrace this plan and see it as something that was effective and meaningful for us. We also went another step there and decided that one of the most important things we could do was to make this hopefully the umbrella strategic plan for anybody looking at conservation plans around the state. I'll talk about that a little more later, but we do believe that one of the things we're going to do, for example, is we're going to put electronic links. This plan will be available in December, both electronically and in hard copy. In the electronic copy, what we would like to do is have links to all the other conservation-related plans, both within the agency and with our sister conservation agencies and other state agencies that are involved in conservation and recreation activities, so that you could go to the end of the plan and look at our state wildlife action plan. You could go look at shrimp action plans. You could look at those kinds of plans by going to this plan. So it would then become a clearinghouse for all conservation plans around the state. You see the schedule here. We have put together around the state 12 aquatic-based. I think I got a picture of that. No, I know. We have 12 aquatic-based ecoregions that we've defined. Historically in the state, the Wildlife Division in particular has looked at the state in terms of terrestrial ecosystems. There's some 10 or 12 acknowledged terrestrial ecosystems around the state. With the recent focus in the last few years on the importance of water to both conservation and people in Texas, we thought it would make good sense to kind of overlay an aquatic system over the existing terrestrial system. So we went out and looked at the major aquatic drainages in the state. There are actually 10 of those. A couple of them are so big we had to break them in half in order to make them manageable. So we came up with these 12 aquatic ecosystems. In each one of those systems, we have put together these forums where we have gone out and with our own folks and with our partners had substantive discussions and debate about what's important for conservation and recreation in Texas. That information is flowing back into the agency's project management office under the direction of Gene Munoz and with support from Larry Seek and myself. We are trying to compile at least the original or the preliminary draft of a new land and water plan that would be simpler, would be a little more visually attractive, but would still capture the essential essence of what's important to this agency from a strategic perspective. We are at this point putting together the first draft. I've talked with several of you offline here today. I will begin today to get with each one of the commissioners independently to show you where we are in this early draft process, to solicit your feedback and approval. And as you can see here, we plan to this summer go out to the public for public meetings. Let me back up one schedule. We're writing the draft document right now at the beginning of June. As you can see there, this month and early next month, I plan to get with each and every one of you to let you see where we are, to make sure you're happy with the direction that we're taking. I'm keeping Mr. Smith in the loop very frequently so that he knows what's going on. Our goal is to get out in front of the public in July with public hearings. So anybody that wants to will be able to come to these public hearings. Here's where we have them set up right now around the state. We may add one or more to this. We're kind of evolving the best place to do these. At that point, we will roll out our draft document. We will say to the public, what do you think? Give us some feedback. It gives us then time to go back to the drawing board if we need to. You'll notice here then that in October, we would compile all those comments. At that point, we would have comments back from the commission. We would put the draft together so that we would come to you in November at your November commission meeting with a proposed new land and water plan for your approval. Assuming that approval occurs, we would then print that plan and have it out by Christmas or before Christmas. I will say there's been a lot of work that isn't very well recognized here. It would be virtually impossible for me to thank everybody. For each one of these 12 aquatic regions, we've put together a point of contact and a backup. Those are people that work for Texas Parks and Wildlife, either scientists or law enforcement officers or folks involved in recreation, who have pulled together these large groups. And sometimes you're talking 70, 80 people that come into these groups and talk about the what we should have in this plan. So my special thanks to all the folks that have been working hard on this. I'm looking forward to getting with the commission to show you where we are, and I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Any questions?
On the public meetings, how are they advertised, or how do everyone know exactly where to go and how to get there? And
much the same as we do for the regulatory process, and so we will be posting these in newspapers. We will be working with Lydia Saldana and her crew to get the word out with whatever media is available to us to do so. We also, I might point out, we have invited, thus far there have been over 100 other organizations that have participated in this exercise. And I'm talking about friends like the Nature Conservancy and the Sierra Club and those kinds of organizations, as well as Southwestern Cattle Raisers Association and other groups that are not necessarily always associated with us. So 3,000 individuals and 100 organizations, in addition to Texas Parks and Wildlife, have already been a part of the process. And so the word is out there that this is going on. We hope that network will really be our most powerful vehicle for getting the word out about the public hearings. But we will go through the other typical processes that don't necessarily prove quite as successful as word of mouth.
Any other comments or questions for Scott? On behalf of the commission, I'd like to thank you and all those people that have worked on this, because it is an ongoing challenge, and long-range strategic plans are oftentimes a real effort to create, and then they don't ever get followed up on. And in this case, I think we are following up on it, and I think it's provided a real good guideline for us to move forward. So thank you.
Thank you.
Let's see, that brings us to item number 3, rate schedule regarding damages to department properties. Also, Scott and Mr. Ted Hollingsworth.
Yeah. For the record, Mr. Chairman and Commissioners, my name is Scott Boroff, Deputy Executive Director of Operations, and Mr. Ted Hollingsworth is going to do the bulk of this presentation as Director of our Land Conservation Program. I'm going to say very little except to introduce the fact that, given that we have lands both in the Parks Division and the Wildlife Division, that pretty regularly are the subject of infrastructure projects like mineral recovery, pipeline, utility, seismic, and other proposals. We have historically had some problem in negotiating the fees that we're going to charge for both the direct impact to the property as the projects go on, and then the ongoing recovery for the use of the property after that. We, about a year ago, decided to put together a standardized damage and fee schedule, which we have had in place now for a year, has proven to be very successful, in my opinion, in reducing the amount of conflict that we've had with folks when we were trying to negotiate every single contract separately. So it has been out there for about a year. We're here today to kind of brief you on it and to offer you the opportunity to give us any direction or feedback you might have. And with that, I'll hand it over to Mr. Hollingsworth.
Chairman, Commissioners, good morning. My name is Ted Hollingsworth. I'm with the Land Conservation Program. I won't reintroduce this. Scott did a fine job. Obviously, with 1.3 million acres across the state, try as we might, we sometimes can't stay out of the way of oil and gas recovery, especially where we don't own the minerals, pipelines. Now, we do have regulations that state that we only allow this kind of activity where there's no reasonable and prudent alternative, but it just turns out that sometimes there's not a reasonable and prudent alternative. Utility easements likewise. Historically, we have not had a published rate schedule, and for years and years and years, the first question we get asked by applicants is, can we see your rate schedule? And the fact that we haven't had one has just made negotiations a little more complicated than they needed to be. Staff is recommending, or has recommended for a long time, that we put something in writing that at least forms a basis for those negotiations, so it doesn't appear that staff is arbitrary going into these negotiations. It does assure some consistency. Now, it's difficult to achieve real consistency between, say, the Panhandle and Southeast Texas and the Valley, but it really is a good start. It helps a lot. And it does minimize applicant attempts to go around staff. Some of you have probably experienced this. Sometimes the governor's office gets involved or local elected officials get involved, and the first complaint is that we don't have anything in writing, and therefore staff is arbitrarily trying to assign rates. Also, having published rates, especially, we try to keep these sort of on the high end, try and keep them pretty liberal in terms of expecting a lot for damages to our properties. And it does encourage applicants to try and find ways to go around as where feasible. It raises the bar for that no feasible, that no prudent alternative standard. The fees could be adopted in different manner. We're using them now effectively as guidelines. Today really is only a briefing. They could be adopted as policy or rule. However, what we're finding is that using them as guidelines informally has just done a lot to simplify negotiations and minimize complaints we've had about the process. With that, we certainly do welcome any comments you might have, either specifically about the rates or about the process or how it's worked or what the options are, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
My first comment on this, I understand the need to create some general parameters that we work within, but I guess I'm a little concerned that these parameters may be limiting in certain areas. For instance, if you have a very sensitive environmental issue or a sensitive area due to either plant or animal life in that area, I don't want to limit the amount that we could charge. Using this as a floor or maybe a basis to work from, I think is fine, but I think for us to try to get a particular number that would be applicable to any area in the state is limiting on our part.
Yes, sir. We are very sensitive to that, and I think you'll find with every category of impact, these are stated to be minimums, and there are caveats in there that say for sensitive habitats, for habitats occupied by state-listed species, for operations where there are going to be clearly ancillary impacts, such as noise impacts, activity impacts, and so forth, staff will negotiate the rates upwards accordingly. And we are doing that. In some cases, we've negotiated rates down because of the minimal nature of the impact or the fact that the easement has been in place for decades. In some cases, we are negotiating them up significantly because they include wetlands, they include occupied habitat, they include sensitive habitats.
Sure. I might also say, Chairman Bivens, that that's one of the reasons that we decided internally to keep these as guidelines at this point. We didn't feel like we wanted to come back to the commission or the executive director every time we wanted to negotiate something like that. I will say that on any of these very sensitive negotiations or issues, we certainly are keeping the executive director in the loop, and he's doing the same with the commission. So we felt like it was best to keep these as guidelines. We wanted to be sure y'all understood that and supported that. That's one of the reasons for the briefing today.
Good. And I think that, you know, to express this on the public record is what I'm trying to get accomplished here, that they are guidelines. They're not set in stone numbers that we apply across the state. So.
Well, I don't read it as a... I'm looking at the pages aren't numbered, but under the section draft for utility easements and permits, then you have the fee schedule on the next page. If you look at the damage assessment for a new easement for a 20-foot electric line, you say $100 minimum, but it says $5 a rod. You may mean $5 a rod minimum, but I don't. Somebody could be cantankerous and say that's the stated price.
Well, it says at the top of the chart, utility minimum damage and fee schedule.
Okay. I think you should clarify if we're going to do this somehow. Note that in a footnote or in the whole schedule that all of these numbers are the minimum that has to be paid, so there can be nobody raising a question with you that it's a minimum on one side but not on the other. But then I come back to the notion of why on the last in that same section under television cable we say whatever the market will bear. Seems to me that's what we ought to be getting on all of these. I understand the point of having a minimum, but why we single out television cable and say whatever the market will bear?
Well, because historically, if a television cable services 6 downstream customers, or if it services 6,000 downstream customers, it makes a profound difference in what the market will bear, more so than with, you know, if you have 132 kilovolt high line, you know that that's got a large number of downstream customers. And that one in particular has just proven to be very awkward because of how variable it is.
But that's what I'm saying. Doesn't that lead you right back to the point you're trying to avoid, which is this a complaint by a prospective condemnor that you're being arbitrary? And
yes, sir. That one's probably it's the only one that says that, and you went right to it. but that one is problematic, and that's the reason that language is there. And we are tightening these up as we use them. We've already adjusted several of these upwards, quite frankly. And the market has changed dramatically the last 3 or 4 years. For pipelines in Southeast Texas, what the market will bear has probably doubled in the last 5 or 6 years, and we are trying to stay on top of what's going on in the private sector. We're staying in touch with the University of Texas system, with the General Land Office, and we are trying to keep our rates a little ahead of everybody else's rates.
Well, I was going to say some of these rates to me look low based on pipeline easements I've negotiated west of Fort Worth. They're substantially higher than these.
Give me some numbers. I'll stick them in.
Well, fair enough, but I think it brings up a point that your Commissioner Douglas is talking about. Then how are we going to keep up with these?
Well, that's
we're going to have to build in a system somehow, because these are ever-changing. Right.
Yes, sir, but historically, we've had to go do the homework every single time we've had an application. And we're still going to continue to have to do that, obviously. we don't get a pipeline request every day. We get two or three a year, and depending upon where they are in the state, we need to be flexible. This has helped a great deal, though, in setting a baseline for those negotiations. But you're absolutely right. We'll have to continue to try and stay on top of the market. And quite frankly, David Riskin in State Parks, Dennis Gissel in Wildlife, and myself in Land Conservation, it's the three of us that are working all of these for 1.3 million acres in Texas. So it's a challenge, and this is making our job a little bit easier.
Benchmarking relative to other states, are they doing it this way also? Is every state different? I mean, has anybody looked at how other states are doing it?
We contacted a couple of adjacent states, and they said, gosh, could we have a copy of yours when you're done with it? The General Land Office has also, and the University of Texas system, and in fact, the City of Austin has already been over to visit with me and look at this. Our rates are a little steeper. Our published rates are a little steeper than those at GLO and University of Texas systems. They're anxious to see our rates so that they can maybe adjust theirs upward accordingly. And of course, as you well know, it varies a lot across the state.
Oh, yeah.
Well,
get Commissioner Duggins on there because he'll be aggressive. So yeah. Get him to help with prices. So.
Surprising to us when we looked at GLO that these numbers are significantly higher than GLO's numbers that they charge for the similar kinds of easements.
Any particular reason? Just that they haven't updated theirs maybe, or do we know yet?
I wouldn't venture as to guess.
Okay, more. Well, that's what I'm saying about, and I'm glad you are a benchmark, but let's see if we can look into those kind of things. And, I guess my worry, the idea is great. Guidelines are, I think, the right way to go. It's just that you have to come up with some process that then you have to keep up with it.
Well, I think something like an annual formal review would be something good that we could do. We could certainly tap into the expertise on the commission as well as other folks that we know in the industry, and once a year go back and then look at these things and try to do some kind of benchmarking against current market conditions and see if we need to do some adjusting.
I'd join you. I think it ought to be reviewed, the rate schedule anyway.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about primarily, yeah. And the flexibility of them being guidelines. I like that, too. I mean, that makes sense to me. You don't want to get locked into any numbers. We all know things change. Literally could change overnight. Yeah. Especially some of this. Okay.
You'll have a copy again, and you've got my email address. If you see some numbers in there that you think we need to work on, I've made adjustments to the thing probably monthly since I first printed a year ago, as the markets change and as we learn more about what the markets will bear.
Great. Any other comments? Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate it. Committee item number 4, excavation of archaeological site at Seminole Canyon State Park and Historic Site. Mr. Tim Roberts.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen of the Commission. My name is Michael Strutt. I'm the Director of Cultural Resources for Parks and Wildlife. Although my program is lodged in State Parks, we support the rest of the agency, all the other divisions, including Wildlife, even though Wildlife has a cultural resource coordinator. Dr. Lentz is a one-man shop over there. We have in the cultural resource program a number of folks. There's an archaeology lab with a survey team. I have one historic preservation specialist who takes care of historic buildings across the system, and I have 8 regional archaeologists. And with me today is Mr. Tim Roberts. From far west Texas, he is officed in Davis Mountain State Park, and he's here to talk to you today about something that for us was a pretty exciting, very interesting project and a little bit different than our normal day-to-day activities. Tim?
Good morning. As Mr. Strutt mentioned, I'm Tim Roberts. I am the Cultural Resources Coordinator out in far west Texas, officed out of Davis Mountain State Park. And I just want to provide a brief report on a recent archaeological excavation that we were able to complete out at Seminole Canyon State Park and Historic Site. This site, known by the archaeological site number 41VB1991, also known as Lost Midden Site, was first identified in September of 2007. The site was eventually discovered to consist of 3 different features, cultural features, and related artifacts. These features were related to the cooking of plant materials out on the site, probably by inhabitants of a couple of nearby rock shelters. And I don't know if I have the ability to point using this, but the rock shelters, I guess it doesn't show up on the screen. Anyway, the rock shelters are down below in Seminole Canyon. You can see in the background photograph. The visitor center and associated parking is up towards the upper right-hand corner of that photograph, and the yellow arrow marks the location of this site that we recently excavated. Down in the lower photograph, you get a nice profile of the burned rock associated with one of these cooking features. Oh, just for future reference in the presentation, as I mentioned, there are two rock shelters down below the visitor center. There's a larger one kind of towards the left, known as Fate Bell Shelter, and another smaller shelter to the right of that, known as Fate Bell Annex, and I'll be mentioning those again later. Once we identified this site, the overlying soil was gradually removed with the help of several cultural resource program members and local volunteers using a lot of time and trowels and whisk brooms to move all this overlying soil. But you can see in the right-hand side of this aerial image, there's a lot of rock that's been exposed and some gray staining. And that was the larger of our features. It was a burned rock midden feature, which I'll discuss more later. And to the left of that one is a smaller burned rock midden. Once we exposed these features on the site, we hired a contractor to do aerial photography using kites and a small blimp. It's quite an operation. And he was able, with computer software, to then mosaic these various images together into what you see on the screen there. It's impressive trying to watch a blimp being used in high wind.
Tim, why did you need to use a blimp for the aerial pictures? Was it the...
Well, this person typically used, he was using kite photography. I became aware of that from a project he had done out at Big Bend National Park. This was actually the first time that he tried a blimp, and I think it was just as much a curiosity on his part as anything to see how that would work. And in the wind that we had on that particular day, I can't say that it worked terribly well. The kites were more effective. But it was fun.
But why kites? I mean, I guess I'm backing up even more. I mean, why? Yeah, it's just in this day and age of, you know, everything from Google to, I mean, why kites?
You know, it's something that he had just recently tried out west, and he had a series of different kites for different wind conditions. And so I guess, you know, depending on the kite used, he had some amount of control during these various wind episodes out there. And I would have to think on his part there's probably a little less cost involved in using that sort of, won't say primitive technology versus others, but different technology.
Different. Yeah. So he's hanging cameras off of kites.
Right.
Taking sequences of pictures.
Uh-huh. And it's still difficult, very difficult to control your shots.
Yeah.
But that's why he's got this software to then mosaic these images together. He took, as I recall, well over 1,000 photographs.
Maybe digital, and then he uses the software to
create the image. And I was told it's the same software. Okay, thank you. Same software used to map out lunar surfaces, and they use it to map out Mars surface.
I got you.
So it's an impressive software, and he was able to meld
this.
These
is very detailed. Yeah.
You can point at the biggest thing behind us if you need to point at something.
Oh, okay. After the aerial photography was completed on the site, we did additional excavation. We excavated a total of 18 one-by-one meter test units across the site, including 13 test units on the larger Burn Rock midden that I pointed out, and five on the smaller midden. All of these test units were excavated down to bedrock, which I should point out, that's one of the more interesting things about this site. Whereas most of the upland sites in the lower Pecos and West Texas in general are found on the surface, or there's some evidence of them on the surface, this one was buried in a soil-filled basin. And what I'm thinking at this point is it may be a partially collapsed sinkhole, actually, that filled in with soil. And having this nice area of soil, it was perfect for digging these roasting pits and roasting these foods in that particular area. And it may have been a little greener just because that basin would have held moisture more than the surrounding area, sure. So it would have drawn them to that location.
Are there evidence of other sinkholes around that area?
There is another sinkhole on the other side of Seminole Canyon within the park.
Right.
The other possibility is it could be an upland Tanaha or just a natural basin, but I think I'm leaning towards a partially collapsed sinkhole in this case. One of the three features that we discovered during those test unit excavations was this intact roasting pit. I think I'll take a moment maybe to discuss the way that these pits were constructed and used. A pit would have been excavated, a fire started within the pit, and as that fire burned down, then rocks would have been added to that pit to be allowed to heat up. And then once the fire was extinguished and the rocks heated, they would have put a green plant material, prickly pear pads or grasses or whatever, to act as a buffer between those hot rocks and the food that was then put into the pit, which generally included, in this area anyway, sotol or lechuguilla, some of the native plants in that area. And then another layer of green vegetation, and then that was capped with soil and allowed to cook for a couple days to roast. Those plants would keep the food from being burned, for one thing, but they also added moisture to the cooking process. And after that couple of days of roasting, then of course that would be uncovered, the rocks tossed off to the side, and the food removed. And those burn rock middens that I mentioned, those large scatters, were the resulting discard piles, basically, of the rocks from these pits.
Is there a way of knowing how long ago they were possibly used?
I was going to get to that on this next slide. We did find several projectile points on the site, including three dart points and six arrow points. The styles of these points suggest that the site was used between about AD 500 and AD 1550. It would be a general range. We've recovered some charcoal from the site, and we should be able to get some more specific dates. But at this point, just based on the point styles, that's kind of our general time frame that we're looking at. And the top row of points are the dart points that would have been used with what we refer to as atlatls. That lower image shows a person using an atlatl. It basically is... It acts as an extension of your arm and allows more thrust when throwing these darts. That would have been the earlier technology used on this site, and then later bow and arrow technology would have been used, and they would have moved on to these smaller arrow points. Seminole Canyon, of course, is known largely for its rock art, rock imagery there on the park. The styles of rock paintings that would have been painted during the time that the Lost Midden site was occupied would have included what we refer to as red linear and red monochrome style. Red linear would have been the earlier of the two. Both of these styles are present
in the Fayetteville Rock Shelter that I noted near the Lost Midden site. Also, the red monochrome pictographs are present in the Fayetteville Annex site. So that potentially relates those people in those rock shelters to those that would have used the Lost Midden site and cooked on that site. And for that reason, I'll get into it more later, but I've suggested that the Lost Midden site may have acted as kind of a summer kitchen, because there is some suggestion that that site was occupied during the summer months, just based on where that roasting pit is located, and I'll get more into that again later. But anyway, that it was used during the summer months, and so in an effort
to
keep
they're having their own luau.
Yeah, well, and also the rock shelters would get awfully warm having these roasting features down inside the rock shelters. So I think they were up on top, removed from these shelters, and doing the cooking. We also have we find painted pebbles on occasion in the lower Pecos, including some examples that were recovered from Fayetteville Shelter. And again, these artifacts of this particular style, at least, date to the same general time frame as when the Lost Midden site was occupied or used. So it again potentially ties that site to the rock shelters down below.
Excuse my ignorance, but what's the point of painted pebbles?
Well, that's a question that that we archaeologists are still trying to determine ourselves the answer. I
are
think
just peculiar to the Pecos, or do you find them in?
No, we do find them out in the Big Bend region as well, but in fewer numbers. And the earlier ones seem to be more to the east in the lower Pecos region, and appear to have that artifact type appears to have moved westward. Some people think that they were used as totems and curing rituals. Some suggest it's used for fertility. It's still kind of up in the air exactly what they were used for. This slide just shows, again, the relationship to between Seminole Canyon and the rock shelters in Seminole Canyon with the Lost Midden site that's up above and near the visitor center. Some of our other findings included the recovery of two species of land snails and a riverine mussel that are still found in the area today. So it suggests that the environmental conditions, at least in that area, have been similar since at least around AD 500. We're also still having the floral remains, the plant remains that have been recovered, seeds and pollen analyzed. That's still in process. But as I mentioned earlier, based on what we know from other sites in the region, it looks like Lechuguilla or Soltol were likely the plants that were roasted in these features, and that mesquite was probably used as the fuel source in these pits.
I thought mesquite was a little bit found later here. How long does it go back in some of these sites?
Uh-oh, you've asked a question I may not know the answer to. But it goes back considerably earlier.
Considerably?
Thousands of years.
Thousands?
Yeah. I believe that's correct, but I couldn't tell you exactly. Going to the significance of this site, as I mentioned earlier, unlike a lot of these upland open sites, this one was in a buried context, and that's very uncommon, almost unknown, really, in that region. That allows the potential to separate the cultural groups that use this site, because there's potential for stratigraphic division between cultural components. Whereas on the sites that are on the ground surface, it's oftentimes just jumbled and you can't separate the different cultural groups. Also, Burned Rock Midden sites dating to the late prehistoric, as the Lost Midden site dates to, are less common than the earlier archaic Burned Rock Midden sites. And so that adds to the significance of this particular site. Also, at least early in the late prehistoric site, from about AD 700 to 1300, much of what we know about the cultural groups during that time frame comes from excavations of rock shelters and burial sites. We have, in comparison, much less information that comes from these open sites, such as the Lost Midden site. And also later in the late prehistoric period, from beginning about AD 1300 to AD 1550, we have a number of Burned Rock Midden sites from the surrounding area, Edwards Plateau, Balcones Canyonlands, but there are many fewer that are represented in the Lower Pecos region. Of course, the excavation of this site is just an early stage in gathering this data and providing it in a more user-friendly format for park visitors. We've completed a brochure at this point with some of the preliminary findings from the excavation. We are planning to construct an earth oven and burned rock midden near the visitor center so that it gives visitors something visual to see and to relate that story of those features to. And we're also considering other hands-on exhibits. One thing I had in mind was when we complete the analysis of the plant remains, the seeds and pollen and so on, I think it would be interesting perhaps to provide magnifying lenses and those items, especially for kids, to give them an idea of what comes from these excavations and what these things represent, and the food sources that they represented to the Native American groups that occupied these sites. And of course, we're completing a technical report that will summarize the results of the excavation, and we'll present some papers at future conferences too, I'm sure. And as I think and hope I mentioned earlier, this excavation was completed with the help of a number of the members of the Cultural Resources Program and area volunteers. And I just want to thank those people for participating in the excavation and helping us accomplish that. And I'd be glad to answer any questions that you might have.
Well, how did you get it buried? How did you discover it?
I was in preparation for constructing some infrastructure in that area, actually. There's some necessary infrastructure that's going to go into that location. And
was going to go into that location.
Well, it's slowed down now, but it will still happen. That was part of the reason for the excavation is to do the necessary data recovery and gather as much information as we could about that site before the infrastructure goes in. It will go in eventually because we have gathered that information now. And I'll be providing the THC with a technical report on the results in the process of getting clearance for the infrastructure to proceed. There is also still part of the site that will remain intact. It's going to be set aside, and it won't be impacted by the construction. And that way, future researchers can go back and answer other questions that they may have at that time.
Michael, you might just kind of walk the commissioners through the process that we go through with THC on issues like this, where we have infrastructure planned for an area, we do an archaeological survey, and then how we kind of manage that in cooperation with THC. Could you just comment on that generally?
This particular project is a dump station and a septic field for the park. And in discovery of this site, there is already the interesting factor here was that There is already a septic field within 100 feet, less than 100 feet away from the site that was put in a number of years ago. This site was not known at the time, so when we started doing this project, we came across this site. The THC will allow us, in archaeological terms, we can put in a project like that where an archaeological site is or was, in this case, because we have excavated it out. Archaeology is an inherently destructive process, but we are gathering all the information from the ground when we take a site apart. For instance, that slide that Tim showed of the fire hearth, we took that fire hearth apart. It doesn't exist anymore. So archaeologically, we have gathered every bit of that information. So now you have just essentially an empty hole in the ground, and the ability to put that infrastructure is there because we've got that information out. We go to the THC, we tell them that we have this site, we now have all this information. The technical report that Mr. Roberts is writing is the mitigation for this. And the THC, we go through this process all the time with them. I write letters to them pretty much weekly to go through this legal compliance process. And that's a good reason, a good bit of the reason for this project was the compliance.
What county is this?
Valverde.
Any other questions? If not, thank you both very much. Very interesting presentation. Committee item number 5, proposed changes to the issuance of marl, sand, shell, and gravel permit rules. Permission to publish proposed changes in the Texas Register. Mr. Roland McCray.
Morning, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners. My name, for the record, is Roland McCray. I'm in the Inland Fisheries Division, coordinator of the department's permitting program for excavation of sand, shell, gravel, marl from state-owned bay bottoms, riverbeds, and that sort of thing. The program is now located, after recent reorganization, in the Inland Fisheries Division. The coordination had been shared with the Legal Division for the past number of years, and for efficiency and appropriateness was transferred entirely to the Inland Fisheries Division. The picture in the background is actually the Nueces River, for those of you familiar with the area, at 19 Mile Crossing. And it shows a vast expanse of gravel with channel in the far distal part of the picture, a channel in the foreground and another one behind me, leaving these islands of gravel, all of which are under commission jurisdiction, which extends in terms of sand and gravel primarily over the navigable streams of the state. And those include those state-owned stream beds where sovereignty was never surrendered. From Spanish time right to the present, the records show that the ownership is still with the state. The other area is what are known as small bill streams, where for over 100 years, surveys were shot improperly over streams that were greater than 30 feet in width in violation of the rules. But there were so many of them by 1929 that the legislature fixed the problem by surrendering most property rights to the landowner in whose survey they were included, with the reservations, of course, on the water, which the state would always claim, the sand and gravel, which was in commission under commission authority, and public access. This slide, after the technical run through yesterday, I have to explain, this is an example of a hydraulic dredge. It's not really in the river, which is in the far part of the picture, but it was to illustrate the dredge. This is what happens when people dredge on upland private property. You wind up with a huge, ugly hole that's pretty much permanent. In the river, it would be dredging a sandbar, which would be renewable as future floods brought additional sand down. The other type, and that was a mining permit, an individual mining permit for commercial sale. The other type of permit that is issued is a general permit, which the legislature authorized us to do a few years ago because we had a great number of very small projects, water intakes, sewage outfalls, small low water crossings, pipelines, and that sort of thing, that were a real headache for our accounting department to open a permit, process it, and then close it. And so we have the general permit for things like this, to clear this gravel away from a bridge. This is in Georgetown, without having to go through a lengthy process and a great deal of accounting hassle. The other type of general permit that's sort of grown as the program has achieved greater awareness and as land has been fragmented is restoration projects where flood damage has occurred or something like that, or for recreational use where someone has a traditional swimming hole, it's filling up with gravel, and we allow small amounts of gravel to be removed from there. The changes we're requesting to the procedures through rules is public notice improvements, streamlining the process for renewals, deleting a special study of sediment and erosion that was installed a few years ago, adjusting a maximum amount that can be removed under one of these general permits, which were intended to be for small projects, correcting the processing time because there's a glitch in there that doesn't allow adequate review, and finally adjusting fees and prices, which haven't been looked at in quite a number of years. The public notice changes we'd like to implement would be to eliminate publication in the Texas Register and newspapers. As newspapers decline in numbers and are further and further away from many of these sites, it has become a much more expensive venture for the applicant and in some cases for department staff. That and the Texas Register, it's been our experience, are not where we get comments. We get comments, as Director Borough mentioned earlier, word of mouth is much more effective, and it's usually a conversation in a coffee shop that stimulates most of our comments. We would then publish public notice on our department website where everybody can see it, and we would be able to put the entire application up for review rather than a 25 or 50 word notice. We would send email notices to anyone who expressed interest in the area or in the process, and we would mail notices to nearby landowners. We do the mail notices already for the big ones, but we haven't been doing it for those smaller general permits. The sediment study was installed in the mid-90s when the question arose as to whether or not our big operations, particularly down on the lower Brazos, and there was one operation on the San Jacinto River near 10 at that time, were depriving the coastal areas of their sediment budget needed to maintain the barrier islands and that sort of thing, and supply the bays and estuaries with their needed input of sediment, and that they might be responsible for bank erosion either immediate in the area or further downstream. The department contracted a $200,000 study with the Bureau of Economic Geology at UT and the U.S. Geological Survey in the area of greatest activity on the Brazos River from about I-10 down to the Brazoria County line that went on for 2 or 3 years. And that study conclusively demonstrated that even though we had been permitting mining there for more than 50 years, that there was no evidence of a reduction in the sediment that was actually reaching the coast, and there was no evidence of either bank erosion in the immediate area where it was going on far downstream. That requirement was never perceived to apply upstream of the first dam, because obviously once you got upstream of the first dam, the likelihood of it having any impact on the coast was very slight. And we do look at erosion in the immediate area of a permit as a routine part of our environmental review of these things. Excuse me. The general permit changes, one is the notice time. The applicants are required to notify us 30 days of when they want to start work. And then we have a requirement for a 30-day review, notice and all the rest of that. So the time has expired before we have a chance for staff to really review public comment or the other input. The application fee was originally, when the legislature authorized us to have this general permit, they also looked at the fact that up till then we didn't have an application fee at all. And they said the application fees ought to cover the cost of review. Now, we thought at that time, since most of what we were looking at was intakes, outfalls, and pipelines, that one day would probably do it, and we put a $250 fee on there. And then we backfit that fee to the amount of material. At that time, we were charging 25 cents a yard for unsorted material, so that would allow up to 1,000 cubic yards, which is more than any project that was intended to be under a general permit would ever amount to. So the pricing changes, the program was created in 1911 and given to the Fish and Oyster Commission at that time because of the perception that this kind of activity could affect certainly fish and perhaps wildlife and oysters in the bays. And the price at that time was set at 11 cents a ton. And by 1973, it had been increased to 20 cents a ton. And in 1997, as part of that overall review of the program at that time, they continued the price at 20 cents a ton, which seemed to be general market at the time, and it initially set at 6.25%, whichever is greatest. Within a year, it would go up to 8%. In 2009, the typical, whichever is greater, in 2009, the typical is that 8% is greater than 20 cents a ton. In fact, it tends to average between 40 and 50 cents a ton. So what we're proposing is just to update and clarify and set a new base of 50 cents a ton, which shouldn't have a great impact if we're going from 40-something to 50 cents as a base, but raise that 8% to 10%, and that's the price at the gate. It doesn't include any transportation costs. And then to resolve an issue that was brought up in an internal audit during the fall where we don't have any authority to charge interest if somebody pays us late. Our only option would be to cancel their permit. You know, it's destruction or nothing. And so we'd like the authority to add interest if somebody pays us late. And the caveat is that any price changes have to be sent to the governor's office for approval. So the staff requests permission to publish these proposed changes in the Texas Register for Public Comment. If there are any questions or...
Any questions?
Mark, I got it.
Yes, Commissioner Duggan.
When on the first change about eliminating the publication in newspapers and instead noticing by electronic media, would that include notice on the Parks and Wildlife website?
Yeah, we would put the entire application up on the website where now they get a so-and-so intends to, has requested a permit from Parks and Wildlife to excavate material in this part of the river. I mean, that's about all they get from the public notice. But we would be able to put the entire application up on the website, send electronic notice, and we would mail notices as we do now. For the big ones, we would mail them to both the individual mining permits and the general permits to up and downstream landowners within a half a mile.
What about the river authorities exercising jurisdiction over the river?
Their authority is separate to the extent that they have any authority. As is the Corps of Engineers, TCEQ might require a permit for discharge of river washing material. So, but the department's authority is separate and distinct from those other entities.
I understand that, but I'm saying would it be as a part of being a facilitating cross or good communications with other agencies who may or may not have an interest in it, should we consider notifying them?
Definitely, definitely. We tend to do that now. I'm not sure that that's a consistent situation, but part of what we're doing is updating our contact lists, you know, in the transition of this program and trying to get a lot of these little loose ends nailed down. Notice should go to the Corps. We send notice to TCEQ. River authorities should get it. The county judge should get it, floodplain administrator. Those other entities that have not joint authority but separate authority over the same area, you know, should all be notified, I think, of this sort of thing and then coordinate the reviews to the extent possible.
I agree. What about the, I'm not sure I follow you on the role we play upstream of the first dam.
No, that was a question relative to whether or not sediment would be deprived in the coastal sediment budget. Upstream of the first dam, pretty much all of the sediment would be intercepted. It wouldn't be going downstream from there anyway. It either piles up within the reservoir or it piles up in the streams that come into there. And so the issue of whether that sediment would reach the coast is truncated by the existence of that dam.
Well, but if you're not focused on the impact on the coast and you're instead focused on the impact on the stream itself, How do we do that? For example, there, a couple of years ago, there was a big problem west of Fort Worth on the Brazos where there were a bunch of gravel operators mining gravel on the Brazos, and it was filling in the river below PK Dam and impacting, at least in some owners, landowners' minds, impacting the quality of the river.
Yeah, what was going on there was they were taking the cap rock off the high ground and then dumping soil down the cliff into the river. They were outside of our jurisdiction. There was okay. The only element there was potential authority of the Corps of Engineers for filling if they thought that was close enough issue, or TCEQ stepped in and regulated those in terms of pollution in the river.
Okay, last comment on the fees themselves. Are you comfortable that 10% is a market rate? I mean, certainly would be low for an oil and gas lease royalty. And
in 1997, when this was most recently adjusted, the 20 cents per ton was about market rate. In fact, part of the issue was whether our rate was different from GLO's. And GLO, after we looked statewide, they were selling sand and gravel off of Uplands for exactly the same price, 20 cents, which at that time was about 6.5% of their sales price. And so we set it there, and then set within, I think it was 8 months, it went up to 8%. It just seems that the department rationally ought to be getting more. I mean, we're open to comment on this. Obviously, this would be going up for comment, but...
Well, I think it highlights the chairman's point, is that we set these rates, and then they sort of get pushed to the back shelf, and we don't go back and revisit them frequently enough to make sure that they are an appropriate rate. And I don't know how you do that other than require that it be revisited on an annual basis, is what I would recommend, so we don't get where we're... Something sits there for several years unadjusted.
Roland, I assume there's no reason why we couldn't do a regular review, right. Looking at the fair market value of these rates and assess that based on GLO rates and other entities that might be doing this and just check that rate schedule on an annual basis.
That could definitely be put into the rule that staff would bring this point back on an annual basis or present it to you on an annual basis.
Definitely do it that way.
We'll take the
commissioner. Doesn't need to come to commission every year.
Yeah. Just to market value.
Yeah.
I know with Shell, when we reset Shell back in 85, we established a particular price, and it was adjusted every 6 months according to the consumer price index. And I don't know what it is now. We haven't had a Shell dredger since 1982, but it's probably several times what it was in 1982.
But nobody's dredging Shell.
Right.
Well, you can't get the other permits. What's the issue?
Well, part of it is the cost of a Shell dredge. The last Shell dredge was in bad shape when Parker Brothers shut down. And the other thing is that Parker Brothers own limestone pits in Comal and Hays County. We're able to supply crushed limestone to the coast for less than half the price that they could dredge Shell and deliver to the dock. And that's what it was mostly being used for, was the road base and concrete. So
were those dredges operated by Caterpillar Power?
Yes, they were. The problem was the other costs. Well, transportation costs, I'm surprised that they may not come back. You got other permit issues, too. Was it problem?
It wasn't the power. It was keeping
the fault in the machine.
Let the record reflect that.
That's why I've got to stay out of this.
Any other comments? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I will... authorize staff to publish this item in the Texas Register for the required public comment period.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Committee item number 6, acceptance of land donation, Bexar County, approximately 3,000 acres, Government Canyon State Natural Area. Mr. Ted Hollingsworth.
Chairman, commissioners, good morning.
Keep it moving, Ted. Getting hungry.
This is Ted Hollingsworth. I'm with the Land Conservation Program here at Texas Parks and Wildlife. This item is a second reading of this item. If you agree, then you'll see an action item presented tomorrow in public session. pertains to the donation from the city of San Antonio to Texas Parks and Wildlife of approximately 3,000 acres of land to be added to Government Canyon State Natural Area for operation and management of, as part of the state natural area. Those lands are shown in red. I believe it's eight different parcels. They were bought with Proposition 1 and Proposition $3 by the city to help protect the recharge of the Edwards Aquifer. Part of the reason for wanting to transfer those is that there is some public expectation in San Antonio area that there will be access to those lands. The city of San Antonio has not been able to invest in the staffing and infrastructure necessary to provide that access. Transfer to Texas Parks and Wildlife to be managed as part of the state natural area would make it, would be a logical ownership and management of those lands. There are golden cheek warblers on those lands. The Fish and Wildlife Service is now doing an assessment of the value of that habitat for the warblers. There would be some restrictions on public use. They would be identical to those currently on the state natural area. Most of that state natural area has restrictions, especially during the breeding and nesting season, about the density of public activity. We would be in the driver's seat in terms of determining what an appropriate level of development and public access would be to those lands. There have been several more public comments since I prepared this slide, but overwhelming response from the public in favor of making this move. This is the motion that you'll see tomorrow. If you'd like to proceed, I'm happy to answer any questions that you have.
How big was the original piece?
8,000 acres. It would increase to 11,000 acres. Quite an impressive accumulation of land for San Antonio.
It was an urban park. I mean, which is what I consider it. It may be the largest in the United States at this point, isn't it? Because what a pretty major city.
Maybe in the lower 40.
Well, no, lastly, I guess. And I meant for a larger city.
Actually, Franklin Mountains would be larger, about three times
right.
Size. Yes.
How big is that?
27,000.
Both in Texas.
Both in Texas.
There you go.
Any other comments? If not, I will place this item on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Thank you, Ted. Committee item number 7, acceptance of land donation and land exchange from Brazos River Authority, El Pinto County, approximately 700 acres for 200 acres of submerged lands at Possum Kingdom State Park. Once again, Ted Hollingsworth.
Chairman, Commissioners, good morning. My name is Ted Hollingsworth. I'm with the Land Conservation Program. This also is the second reading of this item. It pertains to land owned by the Brazos River Authority to be transferred to Texas Parks and Wildlife to be added to Possum Kingdom State Park, which is about 60 miles west of Fort Worth. The numbers have changed some. We have started survey work. The submerged tract of land that would be conveyed to Brazos River Authority is about 160 acres. The tract that would come to Texas Parks and Wildlife in the first transaction would be about 300 acres. There is an additional 300 to 350 acre tract that we have asked them to consider transferring to Texas Parks and Wildlife. It's undeveloped land, it's all uplands, would make nice recreation lands. Brazos River Authority has agreed to proceed in good faith to evaluate the feasibility of that second transaction. There's also a short distance, about 900 foot of a water pipeline that runs through one corner of that park. Brazos River Authority would like for us to waive future fees for the occupancy of the state park by that pipeline. This is roughly where those two tracts of land, the upper one, the northern one, with all the water frontage being the one that's would be transferred to Texas Parks and Wildlife in this first transaction. The submerged land is, in fact, entirely submerged. And apparently we ended up with, of course, back in the 1930s when this was all initially transacted, we ended up with this piece of land in error. It was the original intention that everything below the pool elevation would end up with the Brazos River Authority. So this is more of a housekeeping transaction than has any real operation significance for Texas Parks and Wildlife or the Brazos River Authority. The location of that pipeline is shown in this slide. This is the second reading. If the commission is in agreement, we will proceed to take it to public session tomorrow and read this motion. If you have to answer any questions you might have.
Mr. Duggar.
Any suggestions of what we might do to help encourage the BRA to convey that additional land?
The BRA is currently in a series of discussions and meetings related to, in fact, there's actually legislation pending that would authorize them to divest themselves of a large amount of land around the lake. The driver for that is the fact that there's approximately 200 small homes, cabins, that are on leased lands, and they've been leasing these lands for decades. The people that have built those cabins and homes have been bringing pressure on the BRA and the legislature to allow them to buy the land that their homes are on. And so they're actively considering what to do with especially these larger tracts like those adjacent to the park.
Well, that's my concern, is that if we lose the opportunity to do the lessees whining about the circumstances and ended up being able to buy the land.
Yes, sir, you can see where the actual waterfront cabins are. Our concern, and I don't want to put words in Walt's mouth, but our concern is that this is a one-time opportunity, and if those lands get sold into the private sector as part of this divestiture, that the odds of us being able to then add those to Possum Kingdom State Park and expand the recreation opportunities there would be gone.
I think it's important.
Commissioner Walt Dabney is State Parks Director. In that previous slide that had the, if you could go back, that had the lower parcel there, we really looked at maps and tried to identify every bit of land that has no current development on it that could be added to the park, because I don't think it's their intention to want to further develop it. Those leased situations were supposed to be a 99-year lease and then they'd go away or whatever. That hasn't happened, and politically those are probably going to get sold to whoever has that lease now. That 355, I don't know the answer. We're going to continue pursuing with BRA, but that would be incredible lands for trails and so forth for the park. The 355 at one time was part of the state park. We don't know why, but for some reason Parks and Wildlife gave it back to BRA, and but we've got it back now. Thank goodness it wasn't developed. But whatever we need to do to get that 355 acres will make this a much more viable park.
Well, which 355?
Yeah, which one? We're going to get the upper 355 in this first.
Yeah, everyone in this first. But actually, that entire 700 acres plus was part of the park. In the late 1960s, BRA came to us, sent us a letter saying, y'all haven't put any trails or developed that. We'd like to develop some recreational facilities on it. Would you please transfer it back to us? We did. Those recreational facilities never materialized, and so a year ago we approached them about transferring it back to us. Since we now have the visitation and the staff and the need in terms of visitation to justify putting some recreational opportunities on those lands.
We can get with you and share who we're talking to and so forth.
Yeah, we've had a good dialogue with BRA on this, yeah. And worked with their general manager and some of their board members and external affairs folks on effectuating this, but maybe we could involve you in some of those discussions as we move ahead. I think if we're able to effect this transfer, that will certainly be a very positive step forward. We've got a very significant relationship with BRA because of environmental flow issues in the river as well, so there's a lot of reason for us to interact, and why don't we talk with you about this and see if there's some opportunities maybe to help encourage them on that donation.
Senator Estes's office has been very, very supportive of having this happen. In fact, they didn't want it to go the other way where it would be developed, so he's very supportive of this, and this is his district.
What size is Possum Kingdom State Park as it stands right now?
I knew that one time.
I'm not sure.
1,100?
A little over 1,000 acres, isn't it, Paul?
Probably.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We can find out exactly.
No, it's fine. I'm always curious. From now on, if we're doing these kind of things, just put the original so we know.
Sure.
So you're talking about if it's 1,100 acres, almost if you get this 700, you're talking about darn near doubling the thing. Okay. be nice. Of course, you get so much more water fans.
Any other comments for Ted on this issue? Hearing none, I will place this item on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Committee item number 8, land acquisition, Bandera County, 732 acres at Lost Maples State Natural Area. Once again, Ted Hollingsworth.
Chairman, Commissioners, good afternoon. My name is Ted Hollingsworth. I'm with the Land Conservation Program. This also is the second reading of an item that is proposed for action tomorrow. It is the purchase of acreage to expand Lost Maples State Natural Area, which, as you can see, is a little farther out from San Antonio than Government Canyon and Hill Country, but still a very, very popular destination park for people in Central Texas. This tract is particularly significant in that it would, as you can see, encompass all of the Upper Can Creek drainage, which is the primary topographic feature in the park. It gives the park the canyons, which are the dramatic viewsheds in that park. We've been working with an extremely cordial and willing seller. We don't quite have enough money in 09 land sale proceeds or authorization to make that purchase outright. He has surveyed out 600 acres of that, which he'll sell to us immediately with an option to buy the remaining. Actually, it's not 132. We've got the survey back recently. It'd be another 103 acres. But there's 34 acres sandwiched between our two fences, which he owns, and he is going to donate that land. Again, he's been an exceptionally easy gentleman to work with and very much in favor of the park. We got the appraisal back this morning. We're purchasing the property at $2,500 an acre. The appraised price is $3,300 an acre. It's a bargain sale on top of his willingness to work with us. He is very concerned that there would ever be any surface disturbance from oil and gas exploitation, and so he wants to keep the mineral interest, but he's conveying executive rights to us so that those would not be leased or exploited without our authority. Staff thinks this is an exceptional acquisition, and with your blessing, you will see this motion tomorrow.
Ted, could you go back to the aerial photograph?
Yes, sir.
You see Lost Maples, and then south and west of there is another area. What is that?
That's Garner.
That's Garner, okay.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Any comments for Ted on this? This is a great deal. Hearing no further comments or questions, I will place this item on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. At this time, the Conservation Committee items 9, 10, and 11 will be discussed in executive session. After executive session, we will receive a presentation on items 10 and 11. Therefore, I would like to announce that pursuant to the requirements of Chapter 551 Government Code, referred to as the Open Meetings Act, an executive session will be held at this time for the purpose of deliberation of real estate matters under Section 551.072 of the Texas Open Meetings Act and seeking legal advice from the General Counsel under Section 551.071 of the Open Meetings Act. We will now recess for executive session. I better give it my own gavel. All right, at this time we will reconvene the regular session of the Conservation Committee. Committee item number 9, regarding the border fence involving 2.989 acres at the Anakwa unit of the Las Palomas Wildlife Management Area. No further action is required. Committee item number 10, land exchange, Galveston County, Galveston Island State Park. Mr. Porky Coleman.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Porky Coleman with the Land Conservation Program. This item is an land exchange at Galveston Island State Park, Galveston County, south of Houston. This item is an exchange for a tract of land that's off the coast, away from where the state park used to be rebuilt, I guess. And if you can see in the magenta circle there, it's an irregular piece of boundary.
This item will involve exchanging Track 1. Parks and Wildlife will get approximately 11 acres for Track 1 in exchange for Track 2 and Track 3. If you can see on the polygons to the right, before the exchange, the very irregular boundary, after the exchange, a more even boundary. This exchange will result in a consolidation of a private tract as seen in the blue polygon. The landowner will need approximately 11 acres to Texas Parks and Wildlife, pay a negotiated amount of difference, pay all the surveying and appraisal costs, plus clear the old amphitheater site to Texas Parks and Wildlife satisfaction. The old amphitheater site is in ruins. It has been for quite a few years. It is a liability to both the landowner and to the state park because we do have park visitors that wander over there. There's no gate to keep them out. Parks and Wildlife will lift all deed restrictions imposed by TPWD on the Stewart Mansion track and the theater track. Indeed, approximately 6.2 acres of land to the adjacent landowner, including the existing maintenance complex. The existing maintenance complex was flooded during Ike. It was old, and we're not losing much by losing this maintenance yard. This is a motion that we'll put in front of you tomorrow, and I'll be glad to take any questions. We did have a public meeting. No one showed up to the meeting. That the Galveston Island State Park Friends Group has signed a letter saying that they approve of this exchange.
Very well. Is there any additional comments or questions for Corby at this time? If there are none, I will place this item on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Committee item number 11, land transfer, Taylor County, 91.3 acres at Camp Tonkwa Boy Scout Camp at Abilene State Park. Once again, Corby.
Again, for the record, my name is Corky Coleman, Land Conservation Program. This is the land trade or giveaway, I guess, at Abilene State Park, Taylor County, Texas. State Park and the Boy Scout Camp is the Buffalo Gap, just south of Abilene, Texas. Parks and Wildlife has a request from Texas Trails Council, Boy Scouts of America, to transfer approximately 91 acres to the Scout Camp. You can see it's the red polygon to the east of the existing camp, the existing park, excuse me. There's a little closer view of the proposed land transfer. A little history, that the whole property was deeded to Parks and Wildlife in 1933 for a park to be built by the CCC and had a CCC camp. The scouts used the property even before it was deeded to us, the 91 acres in question. It was deeded to us. The scouts continued to use the property until 1949. We entered into the first lease agreement with the scouts, and then renewed that agreement in 56. The current lease expires in 2018. If the Parks and Wildlife does transfer the property to the scouts, we will place a conservation easement on it, which would give Parks and Wildlife is saying land management issues, determine where new infrastructure could be built, including roads and trails, and also this conservation easement will protect CCC structures and archaeological sites or cultural natural resources of any sort on the property. In addition to the conservation easement, there will be deed restrictions that will state that if the Boy Scouts no longer use the property of the Scout Camp, to revert back to Parks and Wildlife, and they cannot use the property as collateral on any loan. This is the motion you will see before you tomorrow, and I'll be glad to take any questions.
Any questions or further discussion involving this issue? Hearing none, I'll place this item on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Mr. Chairman, I think we have completed our business for the day. I will relinquish the gavel to you.
Okay. Maybe the longest conversation.
I aim to
please. But you handled it well.
I aim to please.
Chairman Bivens.